Hello and welcome to edition 366 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards.
On the show today, we'll be looking forward to the Olympics, which take place, of course, in a month's time in Rio. The journalist and author David Goldblatt will be discussing his new book, The Games, A Global History of the Olympics, a little later.
And we'll be hearing about the birth of punk in New York and asking whether the genre is now a piece of the city's heritage and whether it likes it or not, with Gillian McCain, co-author of the classic read for music fans, Please Kill Me.
You're not in my crosshairs, Rob. Just yet, at least. But the show is young. And in a fortnight that's seen the UK's Brexit disaster swiftly abandoned by the very politicians who initiated it, Cameron, Johnson, Farage, we're looking at you, we'll be asking how to leave a job properly as we welcome back Matt Potter, author of The Last Goodbye, A History of the World in Resignation Letters.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's Henry Rees Sheridan will be presumably resigning as well shortly after making news predictions for the week ahead. And we'll play some tunes too right here on the Monocle Week on Monocle 24. Tom, here we are. It's Sunday. It's lunchtime. Is that your tummy? Can I hear your tummy rumbling?
Yeah, my stomach's rumbling. I have got an appetite for some great chat.
Ah, I teared up. He whacks it straight down the middle, like a famous old Bing Crosby song.
But what kind of chat?
Straight into the 19th hole.
Exactly.
Sod the show.
What kind of chat nuggets we have to look forward to? Tasty morsels left, right and centre.
I'm really looking forward to speaking to David Goldblatt. The Olympic Games, that hoary old chestnut swings around once again. Last time I visited Rio, it wasn't. Parts of it were pretty, parts of it were really ugly. The Olympic parts were ugly. So let's see how that sort of pans out.
Where does David think
but
we're
he's
at?
A bit of a ledge, isn't he? He's a bit of a ledge around the more sporting corners of the office.
Well, yeah, and he sort of documents the social and political and historical, I don't know, backdrop of sport and makes, you know, puts it in a real, in context like few before him, I would say.
So, it's one of those funny things as well, actually. We both read the back pages of the newspapers, perhaps before we read the front pages,
certainly.
Tom. And obviously the Euros are on right now. What's going to happen tonight, I wonder?
Big game.
So it's one of those things, actually putting all that sporting knowledge into long form rather than, you know, your 1,000 words, your 500 words that you get on the back of the paper. I think it's kind of an interesting exercise. Maybe one we could both think about. Maybe we'll learn something.
Let's ponder. Well, we'll pick David Goldblatt's brain later.
And I think Matt Potter, an interesting booking in the week that we've had all sorts of people who've resigned. It's not just Top Gear and the England football job. Apparently,
exactly.
Apparently there's huge vacuums in politics, which I'm clearly unaware.
Yeah, I thought that was something to do with cleaning, but apparently the key problem is that many of the politicians who people think should be sticking around to clear up their own mess have gone.
Yeah,
and many of the politicians we'd like to see the back of are clinging on for dear life.
Yeah, exactly.
Why does it happen? Well, maybe Matt will make sense
maybe
of it
Matt
for us.
Maybe Matt Potter can work it all out. And before we start shedding too many tears for Matt LeBlanc, let's welcome Henry Rees Sheridan. There he is, like the Fonz, changing the record on a jukebox just by shaking his hips. He's got a comb in his back pocket, and he's got his own soundtrack.
I think he hits the jukebox.
I think he whacks
think he
it with his bum, doesn't he?
No, I think he punches it.
I think he punches it.
Okay, well, let's go. After we've done this section of the show, when there's a song playing, we'll go onto the YouTube section of the internet. We'll check.
Yep.
We'll check
the YouTube section of the internet.
Henry Winkler chooses songs.
I think Winkler whacks it. I'm going with Henry on this one.
Okay, sorry.
Henry Rees Sheridan, not Henry Winkler.
Sorry, everybody.
On the 10th of July, 2016...
That's very muttly.
Sorry, yeah, I don't know what happened.
The House of Councillors election is taking place in Japan. Voters will elect 121 of the 242 members of the Upper House of Parliament, etc., etc. But there's only one reason why we're interested in this properly.
I thought you were playing that lip service. I thought you could wait to get to the end of that sentence.
He's got props.
Yeah.
Which is... I know we've already got a lot of... value, a lot of mileage out of this guy last week in Midori House. I think he deserves another mention.
I love this guy.
Which guy?
Tell me about him, Dom.
So, Rob, I chatted to Henry earlier in the week about this. 18 and 19-year-olds are heading to the polls for the first time in this Japanese vote.
Okay.
And in order to try and galvanise the youth vote, I don't know if it's a government department, somebody's decided to get some with-it, hip-and-happening, youth-appealing characters to draw these people in. The Siren Song, if
real
you will.
Life characters.
And this is the main one. I'll pass you the illustration. It's a talking grain of rice.
Ah, komeske.
Yeah,
komeske.
I mean, I'm feeling more political already.
He looks like a he looks like something you'd leave for the Tooth Fairy. Expecting a 50 pence piece to be returned under your pillow where the tooth was, right?
Well, I didn't understand.
Can I shine a bit of daylight upon you reading the Wall Street Journal? To inspire young voters, Japan tries comics talking rice. For the first time eating, blah, 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 blah. You've written underneath it, end of democracy.
Now...
I presume that's your writing.
That's a copy. That is my writing. Now, this is, what I like about this copy, which has been hanging around since earlier in the week... is that there's an almost Talmudic commentary has evolved around it as different newspaper reviewers have written their own interpretations.
Who's got the funny orange writing?
So that's Fernando Pacheco, who, we know. Okay. So but he has different coloured pens for different things.
Has he written
that was my take on
quite like his shorts next to the cartoon grain of rice? He's
I think
some
so,
okay.
In Portuguese, in Brazilian Portuguese.
If it is the end of democracy, we probably should have gone bigger on that yesterday.
Yeah, I was going to say, grain of rice with name signals end of democracy.
Sure.
So that's Model 24 there first.
Strong start.
I like that. Fair you else. Know the Japanese love
mascots.
Know. What?
Mascots.
A mascot.
Yeah, it's a mascot.
We know that better than anyone. I think we've had some mascots here in Midori House.
We have our own in-house.
If that wasn't some kind of hallucination. Yeah. I don't know.
No, that's a real owl man thing.
No, I was talking about the red guys. Anyway, moving on. I've only got one more.
Okay.
Hit us with it.
15th of July 2016, the BBC prom seasons begin. Now, I'm not sure if our foreign listeners will be familiar with this, but I thought it would be amusing and edifying to get a description of this event out of you two.
The promenade concerts, you mean?
Correct.
I don't know when they began. It's a Victorian tradition.
It's sort of all in honour of Sir Henry Wood, isn't it? The conductor and sometime composer and kind of the founder of the modern Royal Albert Hall.
People have umbrellas indoors and they bounce up and down and it all looks faintly ridiculous.
Well, so there's the prom season, which lasts for almost 2 months, I think, which is an amazing season of really high standard classical music and contemporary classical music and things where people like David Byrne rock up and do something with the London Symphony Orchestra, etc., all that good stuff. And then there's the last night of the proms, which I used to love when I was a kid watching on TV because it was Land of Hope. It was always big pomp and circumstance.
Yeah.
And literally, Nimrod variations, lots of Elgar,
Jerusalem,
sort of
flag waving, the national anthem that never was.
Which now seems a little bit, I don't know whether I'd necessarily...
Post-Brexit, tasteless.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying? Is that what you're getting at?
I don't know if it's tasteless, it's just a bit whatever.
I'm
surprised that people...
It'll be tainted this year.
Who are older than I am would enjoy it much. Don't really know.
One for the silvers, maybe.
But the first 2 months of that, I think, are incredible. They have all sorts of wonderful stuff that you would never hear anywhere else.
And it includes this year a David Bowie tribute featuring Amanda Palmer and Anna Calvi. If you're interested,
I like Anna Calvi. Anna Calvi. Did you say Robert Palmer?
Amanda.
Oh, Amanda Palmer.
Yeah.
She's been in here and played the piano.
She played a magic collapsing piano, which is one of the best live sessions I've ever seen at Midori House.
She came in and did a wonderful session here, as did Anna Calvi, not together.
Indeed.
Deliberately collapsing?
No.
No, accidental.
Really? It had a screw loose.
Wow.
Which is rather embarrassing.
That is
fell on her knees.
That.
Henry, that was great. I loved everything. My favourite element was the talking rice.
How could it not be? What do you think on his head, though? Because no one's addressed this yet.
That's a komisuke key ring. So he's got a key ring attachment coming out of his bonds. That's what that is.
Would you
go along with that?
So you think that is a key ring of the character, not the character itself?
Unless he has a keychain.
It's an image of the thing itself. That's what I think. I think that he actually is a grain of rice with a keychain.
Maybe he is, so you can hang him off your belt and show how much you appreciate this particular candidate, for example.
That you like politics and rice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who doesn't?
You'd have to be tasteless, wouldn't you, not to like those two things? Let's be honest.
Henry Reece Sheridan, I always love your news look ahead. That was a classic one. Hopefully the rest of the show can live up to how we started it off. I'm Henry Reece Sheridan. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much indeed, Henry. This is the Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be looking forward to the Rio Olympics with our good friend David Goldblatt.
The This week marked 1 month to go until the opening of the Olympic Games in Rio. The event has been heavily scrutinised over the past year for all the wrong reasons, ranging from missed deadlines to infrastructure concerns and the looming threat of the Zika virus in Latin America. It'd be easy to forget that at the heart of the matter, this is the greatest sporting gathering on the planet.
One person who hasn't lost sight of this is David Goldblatt, the sports writer and author whose work has graced the pages of Monocle magazine, among many others, such as the Financial Times and the New Statesman. His latest book is The Games, a global history of the Olympics. And he joins us on the line now to remind us of what we should all really be looking forward to. David, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. I mean, is that the case? Should we be looking forward to this, relishing it? Your book obviously tells the story, which is quite a checkered history, actually, though, in a way.
I'm in two minds on that question. I mean, the optimist, the generous optimist in me, continues to want to believe that the Olympics, even in its current incarnation, is a great cosmopolitan celebration of a kind of collective but diverse humanity and an era of globalization and such fractiousness in the world order. These are rare and precious moments. However, the record of not just the Rio Olympics, but the entire Olympic movement over the last two or three decades, I think, has reached the point where it's almost impossible to see the sport anymore. I mean, here we are waiting to see whether Usain Bolt can do it three times in a row, the greatest sprinter, the fastest man of all time. And it's completely impossible to think about it when you have a whole series of really profound intersecting economic and political crises running through the Rio Games at a kind of level of seriousness that I would say, you know, on my reading, that no games, I mean, this is making Athens look on time.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll leave a little parenthesis there, a little bit of radio silence maybe. Do you think that actually this is the case in the lead up to the games? Everyone thinks it's never going to happen, or it's not going to happen on time, or it's going to be awful, or the stadium's going to fall down or something awful. And does the sport tend to always transcend the rubbish that happens beforehand? I mean, you know, the games have always been used for political reasons, but...
Sure, this is always the story. And, you know, when Brazil put on the Pan American Games in 2007, which was the sort of first marker on the road to 2016, you know, a war was effectively being fought a mile from the main athletic stadium between the police and the drug gangs in the Complexo de Alameo. It was effectively under siege. 44 people died and nobody noticed in the stadiums and everything went along fine. So at that level, I have no doubt gold medals will be awarded and NBC will fill its 24 channels. But that seems to me to sort of be asking the wrong question, because it's become just impossible to ignore, you know, the, you know, how we've got here and who is paying what cost for this festivities.
David, obviously you've written about football often before, and they've been social histories as much as sporting histories, and the games, this new book, very much follows that. A similar kind of logic, I guess. Tell us a bit about how you documented the sorts of conflicts and global dynamics that have been played out on the stage that is the Olympics. How much has it been a prism through which broader social, economic, political movements have been played out down the years?
It's been a pretty good prism, I've got to tell you.
It's like the Dark Side of the Moon cover.
Over the last 120 years. I mean, you know, there are many kind of strands of the history of the world of the last 120 years that you can track through the Olympics. I mean, one of my favourites is the kind of long revolution in you know, class, ethnicity, gender, sexuality in the world. I mean, it's worth remembering that when Baron de Coubertin dreamt this thing up, his vision of what the Olympics were was the solemn and periodic exaltation of male athleticism, with internationalism as a base, loyalty as a means, art for its setting, and female applause as its reward.
Now, sounds like one of Rob's weekends, maybe.
sounds like Onanism.
You know, so we've gone from a world in which the Olympics is kind of, you know, a display of manly virtue, of kind of the rule ruling white male elites of Northern Europe and the United States, you know, giving us a lot of ethical and moral and aesthetic lessons. And of course, none of this will wash. And one of the extraordinary things you see in the Olympics is the struggle and the triumph of women athletes of colour, of athletes from the periphery, of athletes from working class backgrounds who have steadily staked their place and their claim. And I think that's one of, you know, so that opens that entire field of social history and transformation up. And then, you know, if you want big stuff, the clash of empires before the First World War at the 1908 London Games, you know, the rising US power versus the old British Empire. If you want the Cold War, there is no shortage of Cold War moments, you know, from boycotts to struggles on the pitch or on the court. If you want to track the history of decolonization and of state formation, you know, we've gone from, 11 proto-nations at the 1896 Games to somewhere in the region of 209. So the kind of political geography of the world is expressed every time the athletes parade goes by. So it's fantastically good for that. I mean, the arrival of pop culture strikes me as an interesting one as well. You know, that the Olympics has, you know, made its peace over the years, not only with political power, but also with the world of commerce. I mean, this world of, you know, amateur male athleticism, you know, and female applause as its reward. Well, that is no longer the case. You know, the Olympics has made its peace with the hyper-commercial, hyper-rational, high-performance sport model that dominates in much of the world. So you can explore all of that through the history of the Games.
And David, when you were writing, presumably you had to sort of select areas that you were going to zero in on and target your laser focus on.
Sure.
Was it difficult to escape some of the most compelling and well-known stories? Because they're so compelling. You think of, Tommy Smith with his black glove, or the scenes around the 72 Munich Olympics with the hostage taking.
You think of Ben Johnson.
Do you inevitably get drawn back to some of the most well-known, or was it important for you to try and unturn some less
take your eyes off the lunchbox
stones?
Yeah. Both of these, both true. I mean, on the one hand, you know, of course, how could you write a history of the Olympic Games and not do the Black Power salute and not do the situation in Munich in 72, of course. What I tried to do was to, A, put these things in context, and I suppose it's also sort of giving things their due weight in a bigger history. You find, you know, I mean, I had 500 pages to play with, which, you know, I know is quite, that sounds like quite a lot, but you find, you know, I'm going to do Jesse Owens in three lines, and that actually, you know, in the scheme of things is probably about right. I mean, I think I probably played down some of, you know, the most well-known stories to make a little bit more room for the unusual. I wanted, you know, we know so many American stories, and of course we know British stories, you know, but I wanted to make sure that, you know, Estonia's first gold medal, you know, was included in the interwar era, where they actually stopped the rye harvest across the nation. So a train bedecked with flowers carrying Olympians could address the entire public. So, you know, it's a constant matter of balance through the book. I don't know whether I've got it right. My readers will have to make that judgment for themselves.
I think the very inclusion of a train crashing a rye harvest in Estonia, I think that needs to be straight on the dust jacket. I wonder, David, rather open-endedly perhaps, but it's moments you've alluded to actually in your last answer to Tom there perhaps that might help to answer it, whether the games mean anything at all, or whether they've always had meaning imbued upon them, you know, whether it's by the Brits, by Nazi Germany, by political movements. Do they actually mean anything to begin with? Coubertin's kind of riffing on the ancient Greeks and stuff, I guess, were the start of it.
Well, the games have always meant something, and people have been struggling and fighting over what they mean. And I think with every Olympic Games, you know, there's a struggle to control the media narrative between the people who put it on, the foreign press, increasingly protesters. There is a struggle to sort of shape its ceremonial dimensions, you know, because these things have increasingly become a way for state and urban elites to send messages to the rest of the world. But is there a core that runs through all of them, that is Olympism, that is, you know, something that sort of transcends that? And my sense is that the, you know, the de Coubertin legacy of a sort of gentlemanly internationalism, you know, where a minor aristocrat from Paris could call international congresses and live under the illusion that you were somehow representing humanity and the common good. I think that has gone. I think the model of the gentleman amateur as the moral, aesthetic, physical and sporting model for the rest of us has gone. I think the idea of amateurism full stop and all of that class-bound stuff has gone. So what is left? I mean, it seems to me that the Olympics, you know, having made its peace with commercial sport and high-performance sport, having abandoned the amateur rule back in the 1980s and acquired, of course, all of the trappings of a global commercial mega-event, has fallen back on, I suppose, the sort of mainstream truisms of the international order. The Olympics is about universalism, human rights, it's about, you know, sustainability and so on. And this is all very well and good, but, and this brings us back to Rio, it seems almost impossible now for one of these events to be staged, and indeed for the whole thing to be run, that is in any way connected, you know, to those claims. You know, ask the people in Via Autodroma or the people who've been moved to make way for the rapid bus lanes in Rio, you know, or the people who are still swimming, and forgive my language, in their own shit in Guanabara Bay, because there is no money to sort this thing out. And the Olympics, it seems to me, it is in real danger. You know, there is an enormous body of sort of goodwill and nostalgia and fuzzy thinking that, you know, high-performance sport and this kind of global celebration is a good thing for humanity and can bring positive transformation. But the evidence is relentlessly and overwhelmingly against. And unless there is some serious rethinking, I would say, within the Olympic movement and the wider, you know, institutions that pass for the governance of global sport, then we are in real danger of truly destroying and petrifying the institution.
David, I wanted to ask you sort of a neurological question, which is when you're watching the Olympics next month or whenever it starts. Similarly, and it struck me reading Game of Our Lives about football, because you and I share a, I don't know if it's a love is the right word, but for Tottenham Hotspur, can you divorce
fallen
your
chain,
exactly? Yeah, can you divorce your fandom, your enthusiasm as a viewer of a sporting event, from your writerly, you know, the historian's approach? Does it inform the one? Can you just enjoy these things purely as they are, as a spectacle, as a sporting event, or do you start to see things as chapters or episodes in on the printed page?
I mean, it's quite hard. I mean, I think, you know, certainly at Bristol Rovers, I can imagine manage a certain amount of that level of dissociation. I mean, I'm not sure that bringing a sort of critical and informed and historical perspective actually necessarily diminishes the experience. Sometimes it's, you know, it's sort of quite enriching, and one sees and thinks things one wouldn't otherwise see and think. But yes, sometimes you also sort of like just want to turn your brain off and, as all the cliche of all great athletes is, you know, be just in the zone. I hope that there's some sport at Rio 2016 that is compelling and amazing enough to do that. But given the kind of the backlog of stuff to think about on this one, it's going to be a real challenge.
Yeah, and finally on that, David, the idea that the Games is about, as you alluded to, kind of a demonstration of sort of national virility. I wonder if you can dissociate, if you can just be a fan, and how you sort of take that. Because I always wonder, as Tom alluded to with your football books as well, being such a good writer about it, it's a tough thing to then just be a fan and be partisan and shouty at the television, or indeed
no
in the moment at the games.
I find the Olympics, you know, does the Olympic House have fans? I mean,
well, it's
I think
thing, it's everyone's
it
favourite
really.
Thing for a month, isn't it? It's a funny
exactly.
thing.
It's not really, the relationship is not really fandom. It's, you know, fandom implies a kind of long-term relationship and a certain sort of, you know,
sticker book.
Mental and psychological sort of bread and butterness about it. Whereas this is, you know, your occasional a la carte or kind of mad multicultural sort of buffet that you gorge on for a month, you know, while having slightly weird and drunken conversations with people you've never met before. So I think it's a different experience. I mean, I very much with the Olympics, You know, I love the fact that all the sports that really don't get much of a look in our increasingly monocultural football dominated sports culture get a look in. So I feel a complete tourist in that regard rather than a fan, you know, and I will be reveling in Norwegian volleyball and South Korean archery. And beach volleyball and the rest of it. So our fandom doesn't quite come into it for me for the Olympics. You know, like I say, I feel like a sort of, you know, a connoisseur let loose in my favorite tapas bar, for want of a better metaphor.
Sounds like a man lobbying for stock car racing to be in the Olympics, and I second that. And I can see Tom nodding across the table here. David Goldblatt, author of The Games: A Global History of the Olympics, it's out next Thursday. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Time for some music now. This is new from California musician Adam Payne. He's been making records under the guise Residual Echoes for the past years. Here he is, Adam Payne, with Tell Me. That was Adam Payne from LA with Tell Me, and you're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly right here on Monocle 24. It might be 40 years since the Sex Pistols released God Save the Queen, but punk is a bit older even than that. With its roots intrinsically linked with the outsider art and offbeat pop and rock that was coming out of the USA for much of the 1970s, it's a genre that links the dark psychedelia of the Velvet Underground to the spiky new wave sounds of Talking Heads.
This complex timeline was documented by the writers Legs McNeil and Gillian McCain. In 1996, the two set out to create a history of the genre using only first-person quotes from some of the most notable figures that were part of its creation. The result was Please Kill Me, The Uncensored Oral History of Punk, a book that's now celebrating 20 years as the go-to collection for any musician or writer, or anyone really, keen to know more about how the punk movement took off. A bit earlier, Monocle's Tom Hall caught up with Gillian McCain to talk about the book's lasting appeal.
Gillian McCain, thanks for joining us at Monocle 24. We're here to discuss many of the multi-talented things you do, including poetry and photography collecting. But one of the most prominent things that we know you for is the book Please Kill Me, which is an oral history of punk co-written with Legs McNeil. Tell us a little bit about that book's formulation, because it's all in the voice of the characters within. So it's all these incredible musicians speaking in the first person, kind of linked together with some narrative. Tell us how the idea for that book came along and how the practical process of putting it together was, because it's thousands of interviews.
Yeah. Legs and I were huge fans of the book Edie by George Plimpton and Gene Stein. I actually read that in high school and it really changed my life. I wanted to write a book like Edie sometime. And Legs loved that book, too. Now, he had a lot of archived interviews from Punk Magazine and Spin Magazine, so we had that to use. But I actually came on board maybe a year and a half into it because he originally was writing a book with Dee Dee Ramone. And Legs was getting all these interviews, doing these interviews with Danny Fields and Lee Black Childers and Richard Hell. And I was reading them, getting up early for work, so I had time to read them. Had a yellow highlighter, and I was just like, Legs' book is so much bigger than just the Ramones. And at that point, Dee Dee was getting a little hard to deal with, I think. And Legs said, so great, so do you want to do it with me? And I was like, yes.
Well, that's really important, isn't it, to have that kind of almost that that bit of perspective from maybe a second eye when I guess you're working on literature and things like that. Because, I mean, yeah, this could have been a very, very different book. As you say, I had no idea that it was just singularly meant to be a book about Dee Dee originally. That's really interesting.
Yeah, well, and it was just about Dee Dee, and then Legs had, it's a very unconventional idea to do, well, no, because Dee Dee was just one person. But to do, he was trying to use Dee Dee as the nucleus, I think, to do the punk scene. And I think we realized that we didn't need that nucleus, that there was just so many people.
And the book is now 20 years old. And was there a sense when you were writing it, because obviously when you're writing it, it was kind of 20 years removed from the events anyway. I mean, you were writing it in the mid-90s, and a lot of this stuff was sort of stuff from the late 60s, early 70s. Were you kind of aware at that time that punk perhaps was moving into this almost, and I hate to say it, but almost moving into this kind of heritage brand? Do you know what I mean? Because people now are treating it like, you know, I think that the UK is kind of officially celebrating 40 years of mm-hmm. God Save the Queen this year. And it's kind of, whether we like it or not, it's moving into this kind of historical perspective. Did it feel that way then, or did it feel fresh and relevant?
No, it wasn't fresh and relevant, and it didn't feel like it was going to make a comeback.
Right.
New York had started to change. Like now, it's funny because it looks like it was still so great, you know. But I remember a Gap opened on St. Mark's Place, and it's like, New York's being ruined, you know. But now it's a whole mall, right? And everyone just seemed self-involved. And I'm 10 years younger than Legs, so I just wanted the opportunity to be able, I missed that time. It'd be so, what a great way to relive that time. And then Legs correctly figured out that it was the perfect time to do it, because I think he says that he thinks most people didn't even think the book would come out. That's part of the reason they were so forthcoming. But that's how dead punk was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And yeah. And a lot of the interviews, I mean, tell me how this came together, because was it more like a sort of compiling libraries of interviews, or were a lot of them done as well just specifically for the book? I mean, did you talk to musicians as well, or
well,
was that
I came
all,
in
kind of Legs?
I came in later, so Legs had done a lot of interviews by himself, like Ronnie Ashton, Danny Fields, Lee Black Childers who were all really important voices. But when I came in, we started doing interviews together, and we really had a nice magic to it, because be kind of good cop, bad cop.
Okay.
And Legs would ask really straightforward questions about sex, and then I'd roll my eyes and be like, do you believe he's asking that?
That's really funny.
Oftentimes we just look at each other and we just could see, we just knew what the person just said, how it would look on the page, and what page it was going to go on.
What were some of the most memorable interviews that you were doing with Legs?
The most obvious is Iggy. Yeah. He was just incredibly articulate, and I mean, he's charming. I don't really like that word because that can be negative, but he's personable. He makes a lot of eye contact. He's funny. He's really present. I didn't feel like he was giving us canned stories.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the reasons of that, he was the last interview we did, and we did that on purpose because Legs wanted to have it so that we could go see Iggy, and we knew the story so well that I'll never forget Legs going, okay, so you went to the Yost Fieldhouse to see the Doors, and you know, you did this, you stepped over the fence, you had this little girl, you're humping, and Jim Morrison comes out and he's got these curls, and Iggy's mouth was kind of drawn because Legs had told him his own story, right? And I think that really loosened things up because James Osterberg, Iggy, knew that we probably knew the story. And Legs' reputation, of course.
One of the things about the book that I find sort of, it's just a complete sort of riot to read, but there's also a real poignancy to it because so many people in it die.
Yeah.
I mean, did you get that impression talking to some of the people that you did, that how heavy that weighed on them? And also, did you kind of understand that maybe people like Dee Dee weren't going to be around for much longer as well? Did you have any feeling of that while you were making it? Like, it was almost a moment in time that you had to document before it was gone.
Well, but people are just generally getting older, but no, I never foresaw that Dee Dee would die and Joey would die and Johnny would die and Tommy would die. I mean, they were all shocking in their own way. I mean, they were all so young.
Yeah.
And Arturo, you know, the fifth Ramon. And so we did this 20th anniversary of the book, and I did the cast of characters again, and 42 people had died.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, is that the old cliche, live fast, die young?
Do
you think it's particular to a genre like punk? Do you think it attracted those personalities?
Yeah, it was mostly cancer, It is for everyone. Yeah. Few overdoses, a couple suicides, but mainly cancer and liver failure and that kind of thing, which can come from fast living.
It can come from fast living, but it can also affect anyone. So it's kind of just a lesson in the temporary nature of life, I guess.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about a little bit about some of your other work. One of the things that interests me about it is that, like Please Kill Me, it seems to focus, I mean, we can talk about poetry, we can talk about photography. You seem to focus on the theme of bringing together quite disparate, scattered elements. Like, you focus a lot on, you know, the found photography, and I've read that a lot of your poetry is kind of based on snippets of overheard conversations. What is it about that way of working that attracts you?
When I first started writing poetry in grad school, it was very confessional and I, and quite narrative. And then I started studying under the poet Larry Fagan, who was an established New York School poet and an incredible teacher. And he was like, let's do prose poems. And he was like, well, no, that's a little boring. Like, jump it off here. And he said, it should be like jazz, right?
Yeah.
You know, it should jump here, jump there, but there's a little thread. And he taught me how to write the way I write.
Yeah. Do you feel that? Do you feel that a lot of your work is sort of united by that kind of collecting, and then almost, is an overused word, but almost kind of curating influences down into something new? Is that the way you work?
It was. That's how I worked for years. But the last few years, I've worked on a long poem based on Frank O'Hara's long poems, and I did it much differently. None of it was overheard. I did it using thesauruses, weird spell checks. I mean, a lot of this, it'd be like mistakes, spelling mistakes. And it was like, oh, that works, right?
Mm.
So it was all contained. It wasn't out in the world, but it's similar techniques, I guess.
Yeah. And the notion of punk as a genre, I was really, really pleased when I first read Please Kill Me, because I've never really accepted the sort of whole, oh, punk is just a style of music. It's kind of a way of thinking, you know? And so I was so glad to see a book that kind of threaded all these different genres together and said, no, this is punk. Because I think the UK version of punk is really, I mean, it's famous that Malcolm McLaren apparently almost stole the idea from Richard Hell's clothes. But I found that really nice that you'd kind of threaded all these kind of more intellectual ideas together rather than just musical boundaries. Do you think that punk has an embodiment today, either in music or in some other art form? What is it to be punk today? Who's making punk art to you?
I just feel like I'm not so much into music anymore, but the whole cliche as it is, the DIY, do-it-yourself aesthetic.
Yeah.
Kids are still managed to do things without any money. Well, hard in New York, but you see a kid dressed on the street, a teenager in the punk regalia. And it's not like it's retro. It's still like, they're a rebel. And I mean, to hear Raw Power on TV on an advertisement, I mean, it's still the future.
Yeah, I suppose. I see what you mean.
Yeah.
It's still like sonically aggressive and alarming to hear. Yeah,
you can't believe that was like, because I was thinking, okay, you walk in a restaurant, the Velvet Underground are playing, sounds present day, and then you think, okay, in 1969, if I walked into a restaurant, and would music be playing from 1929?
Yeah.
It still sound current? Mm. I don't think so.
That's true. It's very, the forward-looking nature of it, I think, gets lost sometimes in people just almost just enjoying it.
I was really down on the youth of today, but now I see, no, not at all, you know.
Why were you down on the youth of today? What do you think is wrong with them?
The iPhones and okay. the Facebook and the just no face communication and selfies, you know, just that kind of thing.
But what do you think can be done about that? And do you not think that that's almost like an older generation in the 70s being sort of disgusted by punk or something like that? Do you not think there's maybe a similar thread there?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. But on the other hand, they're missing out on life.
Yeah.
I mean, punks weren't missing out on life.
Right.
And it was so funny, a woman at a friend at a party said, I wish there were so many pictures of me when I was young and thin and beautiful. And my husband goes, but we were living.
Yeah.
Right.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Gillian, thank you very much.
Fun. Really fun.
Nice one.
Finally today on The Weekly, we're talking about resignations and how to do them well. Those with an eye on the UK's recent political implosion over the past fortnight may have seen some of the nation's foremost politicians jumping the Brexit ship. It's already claimed the country's Prime Minister, no less, David Cameron. And Brexit campaign leaders Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage have quickly followed suit. Everyone is quitting, and they're doing it very badly indeed.
Matt Potter is a journalist and author who wrote The Last Goodbye, A History of the World in Resignation Letters, and he joins us now to discuss the best way to call it quits and perhaps how to do it with a bit of dignity, or here's hoping, or at least with a pithy parting shot. Matt, welcome back to Midori House. Good to have you with us.
Always
on the Monocle Weekly. We've got to talk about this spate, I guess is what you can call it, of high profile departures here in Britain. And we were laughing before, Rob and I, that a lot of people who should be sticking around to clear up the mess have quit, people who should definitely be leaving are clinging on.
Oh, yeah.
I guess that's still part of the narrative that you've been charting down the years.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, it's been really odd. It's felt like sort of going back to the place where I first got involved, because, of course, the thing that impelled me to write this book at the beginning was witnessing what happened with Sir Geoffrey Howe and with Heseltine and eventually with Thatcher, and the whole sort of edifice come crumbling down. And for a little while in sort of 89, 90, resigning took over the headlines. It was kind of as close to sort of rock and roll as people over 40 were going to get, you know,
wow.
at one point. but it was the national narrative. And I think we're seeing that happening right now again. And only instead of sort of, being savaged by a dead sheep, as they said about Sir Geoffrey Howe, this has all taken a decidedly kind of soap opera-y turn. I mean, so the Shakespeare metaphors have been flying thick and fast. And I think that's because it's all sort of happened so quickly. There's been talk of backstabbing. There's been sort of people falling on their swords. And it's all very high drama. And the odd thing is, when this happens, I think, because the reason we love a resignation so much is because it's part of our shared narrative, especially a public one. It's part of our national story, and yet it's the part where the private kind of implodes onto the scene, or explodes onto the scene, and it turns us all into rubberneckers. You know, it's like watching this thing happen on a public highway, and you just got to slow down and look. And I think what we've seen is the good, the bad, and the kind of the really kind of ugly, I suppose, in David Cameron's, where his resignation is one that he didn't plan. It wasn't one that he ever thought he was going to have to make. And you can tell the way he's making it. It's the best of a bad job. It's properly held together with string.
It's what have I done?
It's what have I done? Absolutely what it is. You are watching there, and if you see the footage, you are watching somebody who still can't quite believe what he's saying. It's a bit like the feeling when you get railroaded by HR. and HR are sort of calling you in and saying, what have you done? And you think, no, wait, this is all terrible misunderstanding.
You've got the wrong guy.
Hey, hang on a minute. I only meant for that and not this now. And actually, that's what that reminded me of. Nigel Farage, very different. Absolutely glassy-eyed, very smooth. I want my life back. Does anyone quite believe that? There's a kind of
I started off wanting my country back, and now I want my life back. And a nation of people don't think the same.
Absolutely. and the funny thing is, there's a kind of resignation that I call in the book the conversation killer, and that's a resignation where you have an agenda. Something's happening. You'd rather not discuss that, but you want to kill it. And personal reasons, spend more time with my family, I want my life back. That's the classic. Of course, he couldn't say, So that I can try and join the Conservative Party, for example, were that in his thoughts.
Yeah.
You know, it's wonderful. And then, again,
Jeremy Boris Kyle's Johnson, you know. Days are numbered, aren't they?
Absolutely. Oh, my goodness.
Overseas viewers, listeners, Google him.
Google. Don't Google him.
Can we call you a connoisseur of quitting, Matt?
Yeah, you can.
So who's done it? I mean, we mentioned Boris Johnson, we mentioned Cameron, we mentioned Farage. There's all sorts of other people. Roy Hodgson, the England... This is something that we'll translate to our foreign listeners as well. Who's done it? Who's done it well? Who's done it with aplomb? Who's done it with a glint in their eye and a bit of wit? I wonder. Not necessarily choosing these candidates, of course.
Yeah, no, absolutely. First of all, a word on Roy Hodgson. I think everybody can agree that resigning is... It feels like something he's really good at. It actually felt like something that came naturally to him. I mean, every time he's talked about the England team, about their future, about their hopes, you sort of sense this thing that, you know... God, what it would be really good at explaining
if you let
is
the tape
why he
run
can't
on
do it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, that would be brilliant when that day comes, mate.
Yeah,
that's your hour.
A man
you know.
who's had an air of resignation
about him for about three decades. He's been circling and circling, and now he's landed. I mean, good on you. Some people become the person they're meant to be at that moment. So I think we've seen that, and of course there's been not necessarily among those candidates, but there have been a fair few kind of corporate resignations. There have been people who have been kind of holding on through the whole banking thing and so on and so forth. But I think the most meaningful one, and I'm not sure if the last time we spoke this had happened, was the Goldman Sachs guy, Greg Smith. I mean, that's the one that for me has kind of been the biggest one and the biggest story. And it didn't run as much as it should have over the past couple of years. For those who don't know, Greg Smith was an executive of whatever standing at Goldman Sachs. And things had been bugging him. And rather than sort of say, hey, boss, things are bugging me, he thought he'd say on the front page of the New York Times what was bugging him. And he wrote an open letter in the New York Times, that morning's op-ed actually, saying why I am quitting Goldman Sachs. And of course, it went around the world. You know, he didn't tell his boss found out when phones started ringing at the Manhattan office saying, have you seen the Times? This is perfect. Because of course, and we saw this again with Boris, by the time you can react. By the time Boris could react, the deed was done. By the time anyone could think of anything to say, that story had travelled around the world. The knife in the back is so called because it takes you by surprise. And I think Goldman Sachs were caught flat-footed. It just went to show that the kind of corporate culture where everything got signed off and truth was a kind of the first casualty of legal and so on and so forth. And there was one person standing up and saying, I can no longer work for you. He used the phrase, you know, you're a bunch of vampire squids. He compared it to the Death Star. It became a meme all before HR could have their say.
And
A meme. Yeah. Not the meme. Send in the memes. And we've seen this, like, as I say, we've seen this with Boris. I mean, Michael Gove organised it perfectly. Boris was in a taxi on the way to launch his campaign for leadership when he got the phone call saying, you know what, this isn't going to happen. And by the time the taxi arrived, it was all over. I mean, to do it in transit, masterstroke, Michael Gove, possibly the only thing I'll ever admire you for.
What about, it's interesting looking at it from the corporate viewpoint or from the point of view of, you know, the government firefighter, the troubleshooter.
Terrifying.
If those people read your book, could they use it in a way as a primer for how to preempt these things or how to deal with them or damage limitation?
Yeah.
Or actually, will it just confirm that when your number's up, that your number's up?
No, I actually think I've had some really interesting feedback from that point of view. A lot of corporations, a lot of senior managers have read the book and they hadn't seen... And what for me is most fascinating about the whole thing is that resignations don't just pop up. They aren't just little ectopic things. They aren't, you know, you can always put it down to a disgruntled employee. And we've all seen this at offices. Somebody important resigns and the kind of the truth starts to change. And it was like, oh, yes, I never liked the cut of their jib. No, 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 a very strange person, a bit disgruntled. Actually, that doesn't help anybody. These things are about movements in history. These things are about the deeper narratives. We have been locked in a very, very strange kind of arms race between employer and employee. Well, since the beginning of time. But let's take, for example, the point at which the social contract started changing. Let's take, as our year zero, around the end of the Cold War or the 80s or Thatcherism or whatever. Unions in abeyance, employee rights start to be eroded. And we can see into that mix as, you'll remember, you guys probably won't, I do, being told that we were all kind of portfolio...
Being very kind, isn't it?
Yeah, there we go. I've made two happy men very old. We were all supposed to be sort of portfolio workers. There are no more jobs for life. Woo! Everyone's supposed to be happy about that. Into that mix comes desktop email for every employee. Now, have a think about that. It's a little bit like, I said in the book, it's a little bit like sort of winding up a bar full of drunk sort of techs and truckers at exactly the moment you decide to give each one of them an attack rifle. It's just not smart. And yet, desktop email meant that we were all suddenly just one itchy trigger finger away from a CC everybody, CC the press, here's what I don't like about it. History will find a way.
I do that on a weekly basis. No one seems to have noticed.
Absolutely. Well, and we all see the funny thing is that a load of people I've spoken to have since confessed to me, and I've helped some people write them, that they have unsent drafts waiting.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Unsent drafts. Just pull my trigger one more time. Just one more crappy Monday morning
powder.
PowerPoint.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
you know.
It can be quite therapeutic to commit these things. Mm. You know, to print, even if
absolutely.
You don't, even if you don't hit send. I wonder how often. You know, the click send is, I don't know, an afterthought. Or
it's everyday voodoo, isn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's the interesting thing. The other thing from the point of view of politicians, I suppose, and those in the public eye, it used to be the case that when they were on a bit of a sticky wicket, and let's take the Profumo affair, they could disappear off to the country pile for a little while, drink some sherry, talk to their friends. You see, you'll have to go, you know, prepare a statement. Take days over it. Mm. Have a think. 24-hour rolling news in 1993 arrives and suddenly, what's your reaction? I don't bloody know. Oh, yeah. God, what can I say? You have to say something. At which point, you've got the Malcolm Tuckers, the Andy Coulsons in the room. You've got resignations have to be stage met. You have to have it prepared. You have to know what you will say if one day something comes out. So the resignation has become this, I suppose, the secret hidden part of everybody's skill set. That they have to have there in waiting.
You can be a nobody until you resign, and then you can be a somebody.
You're a somebody.
That's what's the strange thing about it. Can we just also fill our listeners in on, because we've had you in here this is the second time we've had you in. Now, the books have been called slightly different things, but they are similar works.
Yes.
What happened with your publisher? This seems like a kind of... one was published on deadline, one was published with the elasticity of... the luxury of elasticity to the deadline.
I think it's... There's two things that happened. The first is that I'm an author, they're a publisher. They got different ideas to what I have about how the book will be sold. And it's the classic thing, you know, Matt, we love that idea. We love it. It's going to be the really kind of serious history. We want to make it toilet reading. And you go, okay, look, I'll tell you what, I'll do you a deal. So what originally happened is we put out the light and leery version in time for Christmas. Because the publishers need a hardback, because it'll be bright red, it'll have a naughty word on it, because the original title, I think, was F.U. and Goodbye with loads of asterisks. And it will, and that was taken from one of the letters, and that will be there on the shelves because people will see it. The plan was always to have the sort of definitive edition coming out a little while after that and being called The Last Goodbye, a little bit more kind of, I suppose,
with more footnotes,
and the one for the record, and it's got extended chapters and interest, and it's got stuff updated on, you know, the Pope, Sepp Blatter, you know, comes free now with extra Pope.
Some of my favourites.
Great stuff.
Yeah. So
a sticker album. great FUs.
That is the next one, isn't it?
Well,
to tie up with Panini, perhaps.
Definitely.
If I could, I'd have a real time self updating one or something like that.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Well, I'm glad that you've made peace and you're no longer looking for the skull beneath the skin and seeing egg timers in your sleep. Matt Potter is the journalist and author of The Last Goodbye, History of the World in Resignation Letters. It is the Encyclopedia Britannica of...
You guys.
See ya! Matt, really nice to see you again. Thanks very
Lovely
much.
Lovely to be here again. Thank you.
That is it, Tom, for edition 366 of the Monocle Weekly. The show gets better and better.
I know, but I feel, Rob, in some ways, to sort of honour Matt Potter's presence, we should sort of somehow sign off with a flourish, but I don't have the kind of...
I feel
of,
like it might be tempting fate.
Well, and all I'm seeing is just Fs and asterisks left and right.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't want to get some kind
it's
of...
It's a family show.
Don't want to get some kind of ombudsman on my case.
Oh, I love an ombudsman.
What I did want to ask Matt, and I wondered whether this has ever happened, is that, you know, you get ambulance chasing journalists, obviously, that sort of thing. I wondered, does he ever get, if he's sort of knocking around Westminster, do people say, is that Matt Potter? I wonder who he's here to see.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes, exactly.
Stealthily followed by some tabloid hack wondering who's quitting next.
That kind of turns up at every awful moment. Just writing some quiet notes. Sitting near a cabinet minister quietly.
Just observing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the woman in black. Whenever she appears, something awful happens.
Uh-oh.
Oh, my God,
Matt Potter's in.
I know. We mean that in the best possible sense, Matt.
Of course.
If you're listening to this, we don't mean that.
Indeed.
You know what I mean. I think we had three fantastic guests.
I liked Tom's Punk Chat
as well. That's a fantastic book. It is one of the sort of three best books about music.
Yeah.
Right, it was Stoned.
And one of my favourite writers' names of all time. Legs McNeil.
I know, Legs McNeil. I know, so it's good, isn't it?
Legends sort of, from beginning,
sort
from
like
first to last.
Slightly pornographic 70s footballer. Do you know what I mean? Here comes Legs McNeil. It's like Legs McNeil. Is she a dancer? No, it's a footballer plays for Burton and Hove Albion. Brighton and Hove Albion.
Well, no, but in a fancy land, Rob, you can be where, can take you wherever you want to go.
It is fancy football. Shall we thank our friends behind the glass? Today's show is produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Thanks, Toby.
Thanks too to Kieran Banerjee. He got involved with the desk as well. That sounds really dodgy, but I just mean he was on the desk.
He didn't.
Still sounds dodgy.
That sounds worse.
He was twiddling the knobs in the control room.
Oh dear. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.